Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 341, titled The Ties That Bind, Part 2. This is being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001. This program is going to continue discussion and analysis of the attacks of 9-1-1, 2001. Other programs in this series are dealing with that subject are For the Record program 325 through 340 and counting. These broadcasts are available from a CD and tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. Email is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And you can visit their website for a meticulously annotated description of each program, listing the sources for each point of information at www.spitfirelist.com. That's S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com. Sister station WFMU-FM is archiving the For the Record programs online for those of you who are online. And you can visit their website for streaming programs and more recent broadcasts at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Older programs are available for download only on Real Audio from another longer URL that has links from both the For the Record section of the Spitfire website that has the annotated descriptions of each program and from the wfmu.org/Dave Emery website. For WFMU, which has the streaming programs. If some of the supplemental discussion for the points of information that I'm about to present are not clear to you, and I can appreciate that that might be the case due to the nature of the analysis, please contact Spitfire if you're not online. Avail yourself of the Spitfire website for the annotated descriptions of each program, listing the sources with each point of information, and take advantage of what WFMU has given us and visit their websites. And in particular, all of the programs that they have aired so far on the 9-1-1 attacks are streaming. In For the Record programs 325 and 326, I dealt with the late John P. O'Neill, who was the FBI official in charge of the investigation into the Bin Laden organization. He quit the FBI in July of 2001. We also dealt with Mr. O'Neill. In For the Record programs 336 and 337, John P. O'Neill, according to a recent book published in France called Bin Laden, La Vérité Interdite, Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, was frustrated actively in his investigation of the Bin Laden organization and quit the FBI in July of 2001 because of that frustration. John O'Neill attributed that active frustration to the profound Saudi support for Osama bin Laden, and for the American corporate connections to that milieu through the petroleum industry. And I speculated in For the Record 325 and 326 that, in fact, John O'Neill was doubled on by other elements within the U.S. intelligence and law enforcement apparatus loyal to the Bush faction of the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, related elements, and through that milieu, the underground Reich. And in particular, in For the Record program 325, I reprised an element that I presented in For the Record 322 concerning the theft of a briefcase that John P. O'Neill had with him in Tampa, Florida. This theft took place in the summer of 2000, and the material that was stolen had detailed information about every counterintelligence and counterterrorist operation in the New York City area, including the detailing of manpower for each operation. The article that I'm about to read dovetails, in my opinion, with that theft. And by the way, that the information about that theft was from the New York Times and San Francisco Chronicle of August 9th of 2001. Bearing in mind the theft of that briefcase and my speculation that that theft may very well have been connected with the 9-1-1 attacks, bear in mind that John O'Neill, after quitting the FBI, was hired as the security director for the World Trade Center in August of 2001 and then was killed in the attacks the following month, thereby silencing him from any active testimony he might have given about the events. The San Jose Mercury News from last Sunday, that being Sunday, December 9th of 2001, has the following story by Pat Milton of the Associated Press of Dateline New York and headlined, "Atta was in New York as early as June of 2000. The article reads in part as follows. Mohammed Atta, apparent ringleader of the September 11th terrorist hijackings, rented rooms in New York City in the spring of 2000 with another hijacker, a federal investigator said. Authorities learned of their stay in New York while retracing the hijacker's steps before the attacks, according to the investigator, who spoke on condition of anonymity. Investigators confirmed that Atta and the second man rented rooms in Brooklyn and the Bronx and are trying to identify anyone who might have supported them. Atta's trail in Brooklyn began with a parking ticket issued to a rental car he was driving, said a senior Justice Department official who also spoke on condition of anonymity. Neither official would elaborate on Atta's activities in New York or identify the hijacker who accompanied him. The question I have concerning this article specifically is, since Atta apparently, according to the information presented here, got a parking ticket issued in Brooklyn in the spring of 2000, this issued to a rental car he was driving, Atta obviously knew that law enforcement and potentially counterintelligence officials may have been aware of his presence in New York City. What I am wondering is whether the theft of the briefcase in which the late John P. O'Neill, in charge of the bin Laden investigation for the FBI, and killed in the 9-1-1 attacks, I wonder if the information in that briefcase detailing the every counterintelligence and counterterrorist operation in New York City, and including the personnel allocations for same, I wonder whether the theft of that briefcase may have been conducted in order to see if Atta's trail in Brooklyn had in fact been picked up as a result of this parking ticket. Now, obviously, this is a speculative element, but it is pretty apparent that Atta must have known about the parking ticket and about the possibility that this may have compromised the impending operation. I wonder whether my speculation, obviously I believe this is the case, but I cannot prove this. I wonder about my speculation engaged in For the Record 322 and in 325 and 326. I wonder about my speculation about the theft of that briefcase being directly connected to the 9-1-1 attacks and having been conducted by elements that were doubling on John P. O'Neill in conjunction with the terrorists and the Bush/Petroleum/Underground Reich section of the intelligence community, that element that I have referred to as a fascist fifth column operating on behalf of what I call the Underground Reich. I wonder if that parking ticket picked up by Mohammed Atta and a company in Brooklyn in the spring of 2000 might have been the reason for the theft of the briefcase from John O'Neill in the summer of 2000. In For the Record 325 and 326, I speculated about this fifth column and the very real possibility that, in fact, for all of its mistakes, for all of its blunders and all of its misdeeds, that, in fact, the FBI might be in a state of active subversion by this fifth column and by the Underground Reich, a possibility that is not to be too readily dismissed. And in conjunction with that admittedly speculative element, consider the following article. This is from the Los Angeles Times of Tuesday, November 6th of the year 2001. This is an article by Eric Lichtblau of the LA Times, Dateline Washington, headlined, FBI turns down hundreds of ex-agents offering help, subtitled Investigation. The refusals fuel tension among alumni. The CIA welcomes such aid. This reads in part, despite an enormous drain on its manpower, the FBI is turning down help in its dual terrorism and anthrax investigations from some of its most experienced supporters, former agents. Skipping down, quote, the response we got was, thanks but no thanks, unquote, said retired FBI agent Larry C. Upchurch, a 28-year veteran who is pushing the FBI to reconsider its position. Quote, I'm a little bit perplexed. I don't want to carry a gun or a badge. I just want to help. Unquote. I would note that many of the that the late John O'Neill was very popular with the FBI, and his loss, his martyrdom in the 9-1-1 attacks, which I believe was accomplished quite possibly with the aid of this fifth column. I wonder whether perhaps the FBI is turning down these ex-agents' help, despite the fact that they are, by their own assessment, stretched in terms of manpower. I wonder if this is taking place because of the subversion and the deliberate delivering of the Bureau that I have speculated about in the past. Note that in For the Record programs 310 and 325, I've dealt with my belief, and this obviously is an opinion, that the appointment of Robert Mueller to head the FBI, a former Bush senior Justice Department investigator or prosecutor in charge of the BCCI, Pan Am 103, and Noriega investigations, all of which would have gone back to the Iran-Contra affair and the elder George Bush, the BCCI investigation, had it been investigated, would have gone to the bin Laden family and the partial capitalization of George W.'s first oil company by James R. Bath, the North American business representative for the bin Laden family, and quite possibly through the aforementioned Mr. Bath, the bin Laden family itself may have been the capitalization agent, at least in part, for George W.'s first oil company. Now, in connection with the 911 attacks, I want to caution that this is an extremely complex event, and despite the very important element, the primary importance of the petroleum industry here, and in that regard, the ties that bind, hence the title of the program, I want to caution against oversimplification. This is a very complex event, and to make a very long story very short, people should think of a couple of paradigms. First of all, the mafia. How they will perhaps do one a favor, and then having compromised one with that favor, then they move in on your situation and or use that favor to gain a cover, journalistic and legal cover, for other activities. And also in that regard, this advisory. Think Machiavelli. Think about the prince and the tactics advocated by Niccolo Machiavelli. And the ties that bind is the nature of the focal point here. I've spoken in the past about one of the ties that binds, and this binds key elements of the Bush administration to the petroleum industry, to the Saudi power elite, including the bin Laden family. This also binds both George Bush to the bin Laden family through business connections. The elder George Bush is heavily involved with this company, the Carlyle Group. And the younger George Bush, George W. Bush, the current president, sits on the board of directors of a Carlyle subsidiary called Cater Air, which caters to airline companies. And as some people may be flying back for the holidays, just think about the fact that the catering for your flight may be done by a company financed in part by the Bin Laden Group, and on whose board of directors George W. sits. Happy holidays and happy landings. An article about the Carlyle Group appeared on the front page of the business section of the San Francisco Chronicle of Sunday, December 2nd of 2001. This is an article by David Lazarus. It's headlined, CalPERS and Carlyle Profit from Afghan War, and it reads in part as follows. As America's military involvement abroad deepens, profits are increasing for the Carlyle Group, and it turns out for thousands of California civil servants, skipping down. Carlyle counts among its chieftains former Defense Secretary and ex-Deputy CIA Director Frank Carlucci, former Secretary of State James Baker, and most notably former President George Bush. Until October, the Carlyle Group also maintained financial ties with none other than the family of Osama bin Laden, but those links were severed when it was agreed that the relationship was becoming a tad embarrassing for all concerned. What is not well known is that Carlyle's profits also benefit the 1.2 million members of the California Public Employees Retirement System, or CalPERS, the largest public pension fund in the United States. CalPERS has about $730 million invested in Carlyle itself and in various Carlyle funds. It owns 5.5% of the Carlyle Group in a minority equity stake and has an option to double that holding during the next 2 years. Quote, we're not too keen on discussing anything related to the political nature of the people at Carlyle, said Pat Mott, a spokeswoman for the fund. But she noted, quote, Carlyle is among the top five largest private equity partners of CalPERS. I would note, ironically, and not in any relevant sense, but Mott, that woman's last name, is the German word for power, and it's derived from Machiavellian. Again, that's simply an amusing coincidence and an aside under the circumstances. What is neither amusing nor an aside is the fact that the business connections of the type that the Bush family maintains to the bin Laden family and the connections connecting luminaries like James Baker, the former Secretary of State, whose proteges, many of the key negotiators for the Palestinians were, people like Hanan Ashrawi and Saeed Erekat, were coached in the latest public relations techniques by the Bush/Petroleum faction of the Central Intelligence Agency. They were dubbed by the company, quote, Baker's Dozen, unquote. And I would note not only the breakdown of the talks between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and the fact that Arafat himself, not only a protege of SS Colonel and Commando and Odessa operative extraordinaire Otto Skorzeny, but a distant cousin of the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, himself an operative on behalf of the SS and the Third Reich in its pre-World War II, World War II, and post-World War II periods. But I would note that Yasser Arafat, despite the fact that he was going to get 95% of the occupied territories back, get recognition for a Palestinian state, and get to share Jerusalem as a capital, he walked out of the talks the same day that petroleum man Dick Cheney, the former Secretary of Defense of the elder George Bush, was appointed to be the vice presidential candidate for George W. Bush. I would also note in that regard, although we don't have time to go into it in these programs, it will be reprised in a future broadcast. The Israeli right wing also has not only a fascist heritage and numerous fascist connections, but it also has very strong ties to the American right. A number of programs dealing with that. Miscellaneous archive shows M30, M58, For the Record programs 94, and 262 go into some of those connections. And I would also note that one of the For the Record shows, I've forgotten which off the top of my head, but it's one of the programs called Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. It's in the 130s, deals with an allegation in the book Gideon's Spies that Monica Lewinsky, who obviously helped to compromise Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky herself had ties to an element of Israeli intelligence. So that there are elements of the far right, which and the international fascist community and what I call the underground right, that have ties not only to the most extreme element of the Palestinian movement and extreme or Islamo-fascist elements in other parts of the Middle East and the Islamic world, they also have a profound connection going back decades and through the present to the Israeli right wing, which took power as a result of the breakdown of the Camp David talks in July of 2000. Ehud Barak had staked his political future on successful negotiations, and Ariel Sharon, with documented connections to the fascist element in the Zionist movement, took power as a result of the breakdown of those negotiations, which might have gotten Al Gore elected, riding on Bill Clinton's foreign policy coattails under the circumstances. I deal with that element of speculation in For the Record program 334 and 336. Now, speaking of the ties that bind, and once again I want to caution against oversimplification in this, one of the elements that could perhaps be considered the medium through which the infectious agents of Islamofascism and Islamic fundamentalist terrorism, such as bin Laden, have moved, is through the petroleum industry and the connections of the petroleum industry not only to the Saudi Arabian power elite, but also through that to the American power elite, the petroleum industry, and what I call the underground Reich. And there was a very important article dealing with Al-Qaeda and the frustration of an attempt by the Sudanese government to share its information about Osama bin Laden with the Clinton administration. This is carried in the issue of the January 2002 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is an article by David Rose titled The Osama Files, and it reads in part as follows. From the autumn of 1996 until just weeks before the 2001 attacks, the Sudanese government made numerous efforts to share this information, meaning the information about Osama bin Laden, with the United States, all of which were rebuffed. On several occasions, senior agents at the FBI wished to accept these offers, but were apparently overruled by President Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, and her Assistant Secretary for Africa, Susan Rice, both of whom would not comment for this story after repeated requests for interviews, skipping down. How could this have happened? The simple answer is that the Clinton administration had accused Sudan of sponsoring terrorism and refused to believe that anything it did to prove its bona fides could be genuine. At the same time, perceptions in Washington were influenced by CIA reports that were wildly inaccurate, some the result of deliberate disinformation. The problem was, quote, inadequate vetting and analysis by the CIA of its own product, unquote. That's the assessment, by the way, of Tim Carney, C-A-R-N-E-Y, the last U.S. ambassador to Sudan. And skipping down again, of Osama bin Laden's presence in Sudan, Osama bin Laden, his four wives, his children, and numerous, quote, Afghan Arab, unquote, followers who had helped drive the Soviets from Afghanistan went to Sudan from Saudi Arabia early in 1991. Now, let's hear what he was doing in Saudi Arabia. Speaking of the fact that Al-Qaeda, the bin Laden-headed terrorist organization, had been founded 2 years before he moved to Sudan, Al-Qaeda, with its secretive structure and oath of allegiance to bin Laden, had been founded 2 years earlier. In Sudan, however, much of bin Laden's energy went into business. A contract funded by the Saudis to build the airport at Port Sudan, agricultural products, and Al-Hijra, a joint venture with the Sudan government to build a 185-mile road northward from Khartoum. Abu Ibrahim, the Iraqi engineer who became Al-Hijra's CEO, says bin Laden took a strong interest in the project's technical details. In bin Laden's large house, in an affluent part of Khartoum, they spent hours together discussing which diggers, graders, and other items the firm ought to buy. On his visits to the site, Ibrahim says, bin Laden showed, quote, he knew how to drive every piece of machinery, unquote. Ibrahim had known bin Laden during the Afghan War, quote, when we were in Afghanistan together, everything was jihad, 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 he says. Here in Sudan, we saw his many other aspects, construction and family life. He was settling down, unquote. I would note, as I'm recording this on December 16th of the year 2001, this past week a videotape of Osama bin Laden was released, and he was, according to the translation of that tape, discussing his knowledge of the construction business and how that enabled him to assess the damage that would be done to the World Trade Center by the burning jet fuel in the aircraft. And I would note the fact that the bin Laden family is a very wealthy construction firm, and that they have a virtual monopoly on construction in Saudi Arabia. We've talked about those connections before. Mohammed bin Laden, Osama bin Laden's father, was a very close personal and professional associate of King Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi state, and himself an individual with strong connections to the underground Reich and, of course, to the petroleum industry. Speaking of the Egyptian connections to Al-Qaeda, skipping down, the Mukhabarat is the Sudanese secret service. In that year, that year being 1994, the Mukhabarat learned that bin Laden had played host for a lengthy visit by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the founder of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, a fundamentalist group behind many armed attacks on Egyptian government ministers and officials, including the 1981 assassination of President Anwar el-Sadat. By the way, I would note in that regard, Ali Mohammed, a double agent on behalf of Al-Qaeda, doubling on not only FBI, but also CIA, and apparently military intelligence, was a member of that organization. As a result of the assassination of Anwar Sadat, a company was set up with Turple and Wilson of RFA for number 4 fame, and one of the people involved in that each co-company was Frank Carlucci of the Carlyle Group. Skipping down again, speaking of al-Zawahiri and the Egyptian connections to al-Qaeda, al-Zawahiri, now number 2 on the FBI's most wanted list, serves as bin Laden's doctor and advisor in Afghanistan. Other Egyptians occupy core positions within the al-Qaeda network, many of them known to the Mukhabarat since the 1980s. And skipping down again, this will serve as not only an underscore to the information we've just presented, but also some information that will lead to the second side of the broadcast. Listen to what else Osama bin Laden was doing in Sudan. By the way, the Sudanese were at this point trying to exploit international connections to help get their petroleum reserves developed. Note that Osama bin Laden was in Sudan as a construction representative or as a construction supervisor for Saudi-financed projects. Not long into the 1990s, Sudan's Islamic fervor was already being tempered by pragmatism. Desperate for investment, especially to develop its vast reserves of oil, the government submitted to the stringent economic medicine prescribed by the World Bank, slashing inflation and privatizing state-owned industries. Osama bin Laden himself became the Sudan agent for the British firm Hunting Surveys, which plays a large role in oil prospecting, and whose military division makes about a fifth of the West's Trident nuclear missiles. In 1994, it tried to assert its anti-terrorist credentials by assisting France in the capture of Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as, quote, Carlos the Jackal, unquote, the notorious Venezuelan-born terrorist who claims to have killed 83 people, now serving a life sentence in France. And, jumping ahead to the present, we're going to take a look at an article from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, December 13th of the year 2001. This particular article is by David Zucchino. It's Dateline Narbonne, France headline. It's as if he had died, unquote, mother of suspect says. That suspect is Zacharias Moussaoui, a French national of Moroccan extraction, who was indicted this past week as a conspirator in the 9-1-1 attacks. Skipping down in the article, listen to the identity of his French counsel. Zacharias Moussaoui is represented in France by Isabelle Constant Peyre, P-E-Y-R-E, who is well known for representing and later promising to marry Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. As we have seen, his arrest accomplished in part in Sudan by Hunting Services Incorporated employing Osama bin Laden as an agent. And we're going to turn very briefly, and we're going to deal with this at greater length, to the book Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International. This is by Kevin Coogan, and we're going to hear about an individual who was involved with setting up Carlos's defense in France. This is François Genoux, whom we dealt with in three for the record 333. Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. Skipping down. After his arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Genoux considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. We're going to continue with this fascinating discussion. At least I think it's fascinating on side two of this program, but this concludes side one of For the Record program number 341, The Ties That Bind, part two, being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening. Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 341, titled The Ties That Bind, part two. This is being recorded on December 16th of the year 2001, and it's more discussion about the events in and around the attacks of 9-1-1-2001. We are going to resume the discussion where we left off in side two, and that is with some of the Sudanese activities of Osama bin Laden when he was in Sudan in the 1990s. Now, that was one of the areas that he was operating in after he left Afghanistan, and one of the things we have not been told was the fact that he was working in Sudan on various construction projects, some of those financed by the Saudi government. And we also looked at information that the Clinton administration was not able to, for one reason or another, successfully utilize information about bin Laden that the Sudanese government was attempting to give them. We also looked at assertions that, in fact, elements of the CIA were deliberately developing disinformation and also providing misinformation to the Clinton administration. Who knows whether perhaps the Bush-slash-petroleum faction of the agency was deliberately misinforming Bill Clinton, who had defeated the former CIA director, the elder George Bush. We're going to take a look now at another of Osama bin Laden's activities in Sudan, namely his work on behalf of a British firm, Hunting Surveys, and we're going to proceed from this particular element of the ties that bind. This article, once again, is from Vanity Fair's issue of January of the year 2002. This is an article by David Rose titled, The Osama Files. Speaking of the activities of Sudan in the 1990s, desperate for investment, especially to develop its vast reserves of oil, the government submitted to the stringent economic medicine prescribed by the World Bank, slashing inflation and privatizing state-owned industries. Osama bin Laden himself became the Sudan agent for the British firm Hunting Surveys, which plays a large role in oil prospecting and whose military division makes about a fifth of the West's Trident nuclear missiles. In 1994, it tried to assert its anti-terrorist credentials by assisting France in the capture of Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal, unquote, the notorious Venezuelan-born terrorist who claims to have killed 83 people, now serving a life sentence in France. So noting the role of Hunting Surveys the arrest of Carlos the Jackal in Sudan, and also reprising an element that we looked at inside one of the program, this from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, December 13th of the year 2001, an article by David Zucchino, Dateline Narbonne, France. This is about Zacharias Moussaoui, one of the suspects just indicted this past week. He was a French national originally from Morocco. This article is headlined, "It's as if he had died," unquote, mother of suspect says, and that refers to his mother in France. Dealing with the French counsel for Zacharias Moussaoui, we read, skipping down, Zacharias Moussaoui is represented in France by Isabelle Constant-Père, who is well known for representing and later promising to marry Ilich Ramirez Sanchez, better known as Carlos the Jackal. Noting that his French counsel was also going to marry him, we're now going to take a look at who was helping to arrange the defense of Carlos the Jackal and who was vouching for him after his arrest in Sudan. Bear in mind the Hunting Services connection to SAME and also Osama bin Laden's work on behalf of Hunting Services in Sudan. For some background, we're going to begin with one of the elements that we concluded with inside one. We're going to be talking about a Swiss-born Third Reich operative, very active during the war and after the war, particularly after the war. This is somebody that we've looked at in, among other programs, For the Record broadcasts, or Miscellaneous Archive shows M19 and M21 about the fascist third position. We looked at this in For the Record program number 333. And in some of the other For the Record programs dealing with the remarkable encyclopedic book, Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. That book was authored by Kevin Coogan, last name C-O-O-G-A-N. I've interviewed Kevin many times in the past. This is one of the best books ever written about fascism, particularly about fascism after World War II. The volume was published in soft cover by Otano Media, copyright 1999, and the book was edited, by the way, by WFMU on-air personality Dave Mandel. Now, of François Genoux, who was very active in helping Carlos the Jackal after his arrest in Sudan in 1994, accomplished in part through the auspices of Hunting Services, and bear in mind who was representing Carlos the Jackal, in France, a woman who is now representing Zacharias Moussaoui. This woman was going to marry Carlos the Jackal. Carlos's defense in France was arranged in part by François Genoux. In Dreamer of the Day, we read of Genoux. Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. Skipping down. After his arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Genoux considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. Now, bearing in mind Genoux's support for Carlos after his arrest in Sudan in 1994, the fact that Zacharias Moussaoui and Carlos have an attorney in common, bear in mind that that same woman, far from being an ordinary attorney, was going to marry Carlos the Jackal, which obviously would have permitted the ultimate in networking. We're going to review some information about François Genoux. This is from an appendix to Kevin Coogan's book, Dreamer of the Day. It's titled, Chic François, Friend to Hitler and Carlos the Jackal. And we're going to review some of Genoux's background, and this is only a small portion of his background. Bear in mind his connections to Carlos and the connection of that milieu to, in turn, some of the Al-Qaeda networks. On May 30th, 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Genoux committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal? Skipping down after discussion of some of the SS operatives who went to work for the U.S. Intelligence apparatus after the war and their connections to Alan Dulles, in turn connected to the Bush family and also connected to King Ibn Saud, friend of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and the milieu that we analyzed in detail in For the Record 332. We read of Genoux skipping down. Genoux, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, Himmler's adjutant, the leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Alan Dulles. By the way, parenthetically, that was the surrender of all German forces in Italy. Returning to Kevin Coogan's text. Shortly after the war, Genoux acquired the publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played a major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Nazi war criminals. Another key player in the post-war Nazi underground resident in Switzerland was SD Colonel Eugen Dormann, General Wolff's chief lieutenant in the talks with Dulles. Besides Wolff, Dormann and Genoux had another friend in common, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. Genoux first met the Grand Mufti in Jerusalem in 1936, and again in Berlin during the war. Dolman also maintained links to the Grand Mufti. By the way, the Grand Mufti's links running to Otto von Bolsring, key German intelligence operative in the Middle East before the war, who also went to work for Alan Dulles. His links, the Grand Mufti's, that is, also go to King Ibn Saud. His links go forward in time to people as seemingly disparate as Yasser Arafat, and even through the World Muslim Congress, one of the major Saudi-financed bodies that was involved with the anti-Soviet Afghan war of the 1980s, in which Osama bin Laden got his start as a warrior. Now, we're going to review some information about Johann von Leers, who in turn is associated with Ahmed Huber, and the Nazi emigre milieu in Egypt in the mid-1950s, operating under, initially, the auspices of Otto Skorzeny, and also operating in conjunction with the Grand Mufti. It was this milieu which helped to spawn in Egypt what I call Islamo-fascism. It should not be misunderstood as characterizing Islam as fascist, but there's a profound element within Islam that is, and we're going to talk about that right now. Returning to Kevin Coogan's text, in 1955, with the Grand Mufti's friend Johann von Leers helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important, quote, Institute for the Study of Zionism, unquote, Genoux began to see Egypt as a base for the anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with an ex-SS officer named Hans Reichenberg to create the Arabo-Africa Import-Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo-Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network and included Genoux's friend, Dr. Hjalmar Schacht. By the way, Naumann was named by Joseph Goebbels to succeed him as propaganda minister. Continuing. In Damascus, General Otto Reimer, Ernst William Springer, and an ex-SS captain and RSHA operative named Alois Brunner created another gun-running operation, the Orient Trading Company, or OTRACO, to ship arms to the FLN militants. By the way, Alois Brunner was one of Eichmann's top aides in the liquidation of European Jewry. Now, we've spoken about François Genoux in the past, and in fact, we took a look at François Genoux in considerable detail in For the Record Program 333. We took a look at his connections to a French-slash-Vietnamese attorney named Jacques Vergès, his close support for various Palestinian organizations, such as the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, his connections also to organizations like the Bader Meinhof Group and to people like Ali Hassan Salome, the leader of the organizer of the 1972 Olympics massacre. I would note that the Red Army faction, or Baader-Meinhof gang, included Horst Mahler, who in turn is now a key operative on behalf of the NPD, the top German neo-Nazi party, which is also associated with the American National Alliance, the parent organization that publishes not only the Turner Diaries, but also the book Serpent's Walk that I speak of often. The Serpent's Walk could be thought of as the Turner Diaries for the Bormann group. And I would note that the NPD also counts among its associates Ahmed Huber, nay, Alfred Huber of Al-Taqwa, an associate of Omar von Leers, or Johann von Leers, in Egypt. Skipping down once again, and by the way, one of the people associated with the Baader-Meinhof group, and Carlos, and François Genoux, was a woman named Magdalena Kopp, who later became Carlos's common-law wife, and she was a member of the Baader-Meinhof group. Skipping down again, reviewing this section we looked at earlier, Genoux became directly involved in helping Carlos after the Jackal was arrested in the Sudan by French agents on August 15, 1994. After his arrest, Genoux publicly expressed his great admiration for Carlos, whom Genoux considered one of the, quote, heroes, unquote, of the Palestinian cause. We're going to take a look at, and bear in mind that the woman who was going to marry Carlos and who was his attorney is the woman who is now representing Zacharias Moussaoui. That woman is Isabelle Coutant-Père, P-E-Y-R-E, and I may be mispronouncing that. We're going to take a look at another article from the L.A. Times of Thursday, December 13th of 2001. This is an article by Henry Weinstein and David Savage of the L.A. Times. It's headlined, Terrorist Suspects' Attorneys Face a Unique, Daunting Challenge. We're going to hear about the connections of another one of the people who's going to be representing Moussaoui. This is one of the people who's going to be representing him in the United States, in addition to Gerald Zirkin, the federal public defender in Richmond, Virginia, who was assigned to defend Moussaoui. We also read in this article, skipping down, on Wednesday, Zirkin learned that U.S. District Judge Claude Hilton, chief judge in the Eastern District, had appointed Edward McMahon Jr., 40, his former law clerk, to be co-counsel on the case, skipping down. Earlier this year, McMahon, who was a fundraiser and volunteer for the Bush campaign last year, was one of six candidates to become the U.S. attorney in the district where Moussaoui is being prosecuted. So a fundraiser for Bush, George W., that is also going to be representing Mr. Moussaoui. We're also going to take a look. We're going to return to the article, The Osama Files, by David Rose, in the January 2002 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. We're going to take a look at the identity of one of the people who was acting as an alleged go-between for the Sudanese government and the Clinton administration, rather. Beginning in the autumn of 1997, they, meaning the Sudanese government, made use of another private go-between, Janet McElligott, a lobbyist who had worked at the White House under George H.W. Bush. One wonders, perhaps, and I'm being facetious, why those connections didn't go through. I would also note that Linda Tripp, among others, was working for the Bush White House. She was the last person to see Vince Foster alive. And as I've noted, in connection with the destabilization of the Clinton administration, there are reports in the book Gideon Spies that Monica Lewinsky had connections to right-wing elements of Israeli intelligence. The Israeli right, like most of the Palestinian movement, or at least a great deal of the Palestinian movement, has links to what I call the underground Reich and international fascism. I would note that the reprisals for the Osama bin Laden organized attacks on U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998 involved a cruise missile attack on a pharmaceutical plant in Sudan. This earned Bill Clinton not only the ire of the left, but also a lawsuit, as it was allegedly mistaken, and there were no connections between that plant and terrorism. Again, in light of some of the elements involved in providing faulty intelligence to the Clinton administration from the Sudanese government and or frustrating those, it's worth contemplating the destabilization of Clinton against the background both of the bin Laden presence with all of its connections in Sudan and some of the evidentiary tributaries running in the direction of François Genoux and the underground Reich forward to the Moussaoui family, and some of the connections that I've already detailed. I would note that the attacks on the embassies in 1998 took place as the impeachment proceedings were gathering steam. Returning once again to the article about Moussaoui in the L.A. Times of December 13th of 2001, the article from the front page about his mother's statements about him. Aisha Moussaoui said a French intelligence officer called her in late 1999 and said her son's name was in the address book of a man named Yannick who had died fighting for the Muslim cause in Bosnia. Well, in the past, we've dealt with the Islamic fundamentalist connections of the president of Bosnia, Alija Izetbegović, who as a young man fought in the 13th Waffen-SS Division, the Hanjar Division, a Bosnian Muslim Waffen-SS Division recruited by the aforementioned Haj Amin al-Husseini. We've also taken a look at the aforementioned Egyptian physician, Mr. al-Zawahiri, who is one of the main mentors to Osama bin Laden, and according to some accounts, the real mastermind of al-Qaeda. There was mention of al-Zawahiri, who grew out of the Islamic fundamentalist milieu in Egypt that was associated with the elements of the underground Reich, such as Janu, the Grand Mufti, Johann von Leers, Ahmed Hubin, and others. The Financial Times of Monday, December 10th of 2001, had an article by Hiba Saleh in Cairo. This is headlined, Smuggled Book Sets Out Story of Terror. It quotes, it's by Herb Saleh in Cairo, and it quotes al-Zawahiri about the effort against the Soviets in Afghanistan in the 1980s. This is when Osama bin Laden got his genesis as a warrior, and bear in mind the role of the World Muslim Congress in this. Bear in mind also that Bosnia was a key area of operations for al-Qaeda. Quote, in the training camps and on the various fronts where fighting against the Russians took place, Muslim youths received a deeper understanding of the conspiracy that was prepared against the Islamic world, unquote, writes Mr. al-Zawahiri. These youths, he adds, went on to revive the Islamic duty of jihad or holy war in Chechnya, Bosnia, and Kashmir after the Soviet Union withdrew in 1989. We're going to take a look now, bearing in mind Alija Izetbegović's youthful connections to the Hanjar Division. We're going to take a look now at alleged al-Qaeda connections to another part of the former Yugoslavia, namely Kosovo. We're going to read from the L.A. Times of Saturday, December 15th of 2001. This is an article by Lisa Getter, Josh Meyer, and Chuck Neubauer. It's Dateline Washington and headlined, Two U.S.-based charities funds held. And skipping down, The action came as NATO-led peacekeepers and United Nations police raided Global Relief's offices in Pristina, Yugoslavia, and detained several people on suspicion of being linked to international terrorism, according to a North Atlantic Treaty Organization statement. Pristina is in Kosovo. One of the things that we looked at in, among other programs, For the Record 161, we reprised this in For the Record number 293, is the fact that Alija Izetbegović, as a young man, a member of the 13th Waffen-SS or Hanjar Division, had as his sort of bodyguard, or the Praetorian Guard of the Bosnian Muslim leadership, an Islamic formation specifically named after and modeled after the Hanjar Division. It was called Hanjar. This, again, was the Praetorian Guard, so to speak, of the Bosnian leadership. It served as a special forces unit and assisted other Bosnian Muslim fighting formations. It was led and trained, as we looked at in For the Records 161 and 293, by Afghan and Pakistani veterans of the war against the Soviets. That information, by the way, from a book called Some Call It Peace by Yosef Badansky. We're going to take a look now at an interesting recent arrestee, so to speak, in Afghanistan. This from the New York Times of Thursday, December 13th of 2001. This is an article by Douglas France. It's headlined, Alliance Captures Australian Man Fighting for the Taliban. A 26-year-old Australian drifter who has been fighting alongside the Taliban was captured over the weekend by Northern Alliance troops, Australian authorities said today. David Hicks was a soldier of fortune, his father Terry said, skipping down. Terry Hicks told Australian newspapers that his son became a fighter with the Kosovo Liberation Army in 1999 and later a student of Arabic and Islam in Pakistan. As we looked at in the aforementioned, for the record, 161 and 293, part of the heritage of the Kosovo Liberation Army was the 21st Waffen-SS Division, or Skanderbeg Division, another Muslim Waffen-SS, a Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS formation, but this composed largely of Kosovar Albanians. That from an article by Chris Hedges from Foreign Affairs magazine of May and June of 1999. We've also looked at the fact that the Hanjar II, the Afghan and Pakistani-led bodyguard of Ali Izzet Begovic, was engaged in force projection into Kosovo, Albania, and Macedonia in the early 1990s. And the possibility of networking, and again the ties that bind between Hanjar II of Afghan and Pakistani genesis and the Kosovo Liberation Army, heirs at least in part to the 21st Waffen-SS, should be borne in mind. Terry Hicks, perhaps one of those people whose networking has provided him with, or David Hicks rather, with, once again, the ties that bind. We're going to listen to a short section now from RFA program number 22. You're going to hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
The segment we're going to read next is from a book entitled The Patriotic Traitors, The History of Collaboration in German-Occupied Europe, 1940 to 45, by David Littlejohn, published by Doubleday and Company, 1972. This section is headlined, A Man of God and Friend of Hitler. The spiritual welfare of Soviet citizens of the Muslim faith was in good hands. It was the charge of no less a personage than His Eminence, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haj Amin El Husseini. There can be no doubt that he took his responsibilities seriously. An indefatigable worker in the cause of Allah and Adolf Hitler, he toured prisoner of war camps exhorting the faithful to take up arms on behalf of the new order. He reviewed Muslim SS units, their field gray uniforms topped with a fez. He blessed weapons, consecrated standards. He won over a distinguished Tartar poet, Musa Jalil, who agreed to serve on an Idel Ural Tartar committee, which had as its object the establishment of a Muslim state on the banks of the Volga. Idel is the Tartar word for Volga. Nothing ever came of this scheme. Jalil later had second thoughts and tried to back out. For his pains, he was court-martialed and shot by the Germans. The Grand Mufti himself, however, readers will be relieved to learn, came safely through the war.
That again from RFA 22, recorded in July of 1986. Now, jumping from the past to the present, and bearing in mind the Grand Mufti's efforts on behalf of the Third Reich to organize Muslims and people from the former Soviet Union in order to, basically gain control of the oil-producing region of the former Soviet Union in the Caucasus and other areas that are now Muslim areas of the former Soviet Union. We're going to read an article from the New York Times of Friday, November 9th of 2001, an article by Amy Waldman, datelined Kazan, Russia, headlined, Russia's Muslims Unchained but Still Chafing. Skipping down, we read, from 20 regions of Russia and bordering nations, they, Muslims, have made their way to an institution whose very name was unthinkable a decade ago, the Russian Islamic University. Founded in 1998, the university already has 148 students in its newly refurbished building. It also has the support of a former communist who rules Tatarstan, the semi-autonomous republic centered around this urbane city on the Volga River. Skipping down. The madrasa, that's this school, reflects a younger generation's view that Russian Islam, shaped by accommodation to Tsarist and later Soviet rule, is not worth preserving. The school's director, Malik Ibrahimov, 36, who studied in Saudi Arabia for 4 years, said fundamentalist Islam is the only Islam. And apparently some of this Wahhabism, which is the Islam preached in the Soviet Union, is once again taking effect, or is having an effect, which perhaps was, as I spoke in For the Record program number 334, what the von Paulus' Sixth Army was meant to do, was to capture Stalingrad, the key to the Volga River and the Caucasus and the Soviet oil-producing regions. New York Times of Sunday, December 9th of 2001, has the following article by Michael Wines, datelined Uras Martan, Russia. It's headlined, War on Terror casts Chechen conflict in a new light. This reflects back directly on For the Record programs 182 and 329, among others. In fact, the three hitchhikers were coming to join a group of militant Muslims that had established a paramilitary beachhead inside Chechnya. As in Afghanistan, some were outsiders and members of the strict Wahhabi branch of Islam. Skipping down. The size of the terrorist element is unclear, even to people in Ulus Martan, which many call the center of Islam extremism in Chechnya. On the one hand, the Wahhabi takeover here, like much of the Chechen war, was clearly propelled by outside support. Residents say the Wahhabis also had ties to a notorious training camp that indoctrinated Chechens and foreigners alike in Islamic militancy and military tactics. There are strong indications that the camp and its leader, a guerrilla from the Middle East known as Khattab, have ties to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Perhaps clearest of all, Chechnya's guerrillas are indisputably financed by a web of Islamic charities, banks, and other organizations that have served as cash conduits for terrorist groups. And of the Wahhabi presence in Chechnya, we read Mr. Itslayev, and he's now an editor of the local paper, that's Abdul Itslayev. Mr. Itslayev, the hitchhiker of 2 years ago, is deputy editor of the Ulus Martan newspaper, Marosho, or Freedom. He said the town's first Wahhabis arrived in 1997, not from abroad, but from Dagestan, Khattab's one-time home, skipping down. Foreigners arrived only later, both Mr. Itslayev and Ulus Martan's deputy administrator, Lyoma Goysotanov, said, quote, "I myself saw Ukrainians, Lithuanians, Arabs, and Azeris," Mr. Goysotanov said. "They had the most expensive cars, Lincolns, four-wheel drives, and the most expensive weapons, which even the Russians didn't have," unquote. The foreigners also had money, handing out $200 and automatic rifles to young Chechens who joined them. By mid-1998, civilian opponents were being murdered. In mid-1999, the foreign fighters staged a coup. Ulus Martan's militia was replaced by Wahhabis, and the civil court was abolished for a tribunal that adopted Sharia, the legal code of Islam based on the Quran. Girls were shooed from school, and women were ordered to wear veils. Alcohol was banned. The group left Ulus Martan to join the August 1999 invasion of Dagestan and then returned to take power. By late 1999, he said, there were 2,000 Wahhabis, others estimated as many as 7,000, quote. Only one word would fit here, Mr. Islayev said. It was a mob, unquote. And perhaps, I would say, that's apparently Al-Qaeda-linked element and certainly Wahhabi-linked, perhaps the heirs to some of the Muslim formations formed by the Grand Mufti. This concludes For the Record 341, The Ties That Bind, being recorded on December 16th of 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.